You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Aaron Henney, Artistic Director of Theater Dybbuk. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. Today is Shavuot, Shavuos, the least appreciated of all the major Jewish festivals, the holiday that nonetheless marks the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, as well as the third pilgrimage festival of the year, and the early summertime of the very first harvest in the land of Israel. It was on this day, over 3,200 years ago, that our people received our true covenant with God, and became a nation dedicated to the ethical commandments enunciated in that Brit, the great covenant of Torah. It was on Shavuot that, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all of history took place. According to the book of Exodus, our entire people stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and experienced lightning, thunder, smoke, and fire, and an earthquake, and finally the blasts of the shofar ringing in the desert air. Out of all of that tumult, God's voice clearly conveyed the great message of morality that includes the Ten Commandments. Without this holiday of Shavuot, which began last night, we would not have the Torah. Without the Torah, we wouldn't have Judaism, or for that matter, our daughter religions of Christianity and Islam. The key question for us Jews, and one of the things that shapes whether you are a Reformed, Conservative, or Orthodox Jew, is just what you think took place that fateful day at Mount Sinai. For Orthodox Jews, it was God directly giving us the Ten Commandments, and the rest of the Torah, and the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, and even in theory, the entire Oral Torah, the Talmud. For conservative Jews, Sinai represented the revelation of at least the Ten Commandments, which God spoke to us directly. For most Reformed Jews, it was God's presence and connection that was conveyed, or maybe the Ten Commandments in one way or another. And for atheists, the whole thing was the collective, simultaneous imagination of, oh, I don't know, 2 million people. I vote for the belief that something really amazing did happen at Mount Sinai, something so powerful, wonderful, and potent that it has remained in its content and memory at the heart of all Western religion ever since. And we celebrate that incredible experience on this holiday of Shavuot. But there is even more to the festival than revelation and covenant. For Shavuos, in its own way, signifies the time when the whole people of Israel accepted its role as messengers of God's commitment to living ethical lives. It was, in a real way, the time when our entire nation converted to this new concept of one and only one God, of pristine monotheism, one source for direction and good in this world. It's for this reason that, in addition to the Ten Commandments, we also chant from the biblical book of Ruth on Shavuot. The book of Ruth describes the choice of a non-Israelite woman, a non-Jew, Ruth, who decides to become an Israelite, a Jew. Ruth includes the most beautiful statement of conversion to Judaism ever, in which Ruth says to Naomi, mother of her late husband, that Ruth will come with her to Israel and become one of us. Ruth's poetic statement, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will become my people. Your God become my God," is still used in conversion to Judaism ceremonies today. Because those who become Jews by choice follow the example established at Mount Sinai, today we all choose to be Jews, decide on our own to follow the ethics, culture, and tradition that can make us good people devoted to God. In celebration of Shavuot this morning, here's a play-in from the book of Ruth itself. Al tifki'i li le'ozvech. Do not encourage me to leave you or to cease from following after you. For where you go, I will go, your God will be my God. That was Do Not Encourage Me to Leave You, Al Tivkeili Leozvech, from the Book of Ruth, composition by cantor Lawrence Avery. Our guest this morning, the pioneer artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, Aaron Henney, will explain how his unique company works, how they have revived and recreated the oldest Jewish play in existence, Exegog. Find out all about it when we come back here in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Aaron Henney is the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, a remarkable theatrical company whose work focuses on Jewish folklore and history, and whose projects have included reviving some antique Jewish plays, including quite possibly the oldest Jewish play ever. He has served in a variety of other artistic and academic functions, and we're delighted to have him here with us this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Aaron, Theater Dybbuk. The Dybbuks aren't good. I have to ask you about the name a little bit.
That's great. Thank you for asking about that. So, we chose the name for a variety of reasons. One is actually partially because of the kind of response you had, which is, it's kind of surprising, and it causes people to ask questions. So that's number one. But I will say, we also do often highly physical work. So the idea of being, you know, possessed by something that kind of takes over your body and utilizes it in a way has a through line with our work. You know, not necessarily negatively, but it's there. It is also that name was a way of suggesting to the audience that the work we're doing is mythological, folkloric, challenging, may upend your expectations. And lastly, we also chose the name because it, of course, recalls, you know, a very famous Yiddish play.
The Dybbuk.
So it puts us in line. Yeah. Exactly. It puts us in line with a tradition and a history, honoring that history while also coming up with something new and iterative and innovative.
People may not understand that Jewish theater is not quite as ancient as we might imagine. The oldest Jewish play, and we'll talk much more about this later in the show, it's based on the greatest Jewish story ever, right? The greatest story ever told, to steal a line, the Exodus. But Jewish theater really came from Greece originally.
So the you are referring to Exegog, right?
Right.
Which is this show that is the oldest Jewish play that we have a record of, at least that's been found thus far. And right, is this expression of our biblical Exodus narrative in the style of the time Greek tragedy, likely written by a Jew living in the diaspora, perhaps Alexandria.
Alexandria, right.
Yeah. And you know, right, I mean, and there are questions about its function. There are questions about, did it have a ritual function? Was it merely a piece of theater? Was it used for sort of understanding the Passover holiday? There are all kinds of questions present, but you are correct when you say that at least seems to be the beginnings of what we identify as Jewish theater, and we don't actually have much from that time for quite a while following after.
So in a way, you're reviving something both ancient, and we think about Jews in the theater, and you know what's that old line? You can't succeed on Broadway if you don't have any Jews, right? I mean, we think about theater as such a Jewish institution, but it doesn't originally come from there. And what you're doing is, in some ways, trying to explore the very origins of Jewish theater altogether.
Right. I mean, I think that what we were interested in when we did our adaptation of this ancient Jewish play was trying to figure out what might have been the function of theatrical performance at a time for a group living in this particular place with the particular conflicts and forces and questions of assimilation and integration at play within their own communities and with the world at large. And so we were using this ancient work, yes, to explore what Jewish theater might have been and its origins, and also to explore how people lived and how they processed the state in which they were existing.
We will talk much more with Aaron Henney, the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, who has done all kinds of interesting things in theater and dance, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. That's 276-5675. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both. You can email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us each Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. with Torah study before that at 9 o'clock, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, and our services with full music are in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can go to those by emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, or going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, too, some students live and some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in all of Arizona, and its exciting beginning years. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to KohanAward.com, KohanAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is KohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments certainly help. A somber note on this morning of Shavuot. Somehow, after weeks of public shootings at elementary schools, hospitals, and public places of all kinds, frankly, after years of this insanity, it's been a decade since Sandy Hook, we still as a nation cannot understand that the prevalence of assault weapons, military assault weapons, available to anyone age 18 years old, is an incredibly terrible idea. The insane arguments that allowing everyone to carry a machine gun make us safer ignore the fact that no other vaguely civilized nation on earth has anything like this problem, or anything like the commonality of the public slaughter of innocents that America accepts and, frankly, condones. The idea that if everybody simply has a revolver on his or her hip, or an AR or AK strapped to his or her back, we can stop the shooting of little children is insane. Freedom includes responsibility. We Jews learned that at Mount Sinai 3,200 years ago today. Allowing assault weapons and high-capacity magazines to be available to everyone who can come up with cash is a recipe for exactly what happens right now. In an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, in a hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at a public park or nightclub or shopping mall or festival near you. Anyone in America now can get shot at any time, in any setting, by a person equipped with armaments and body armor suitable for the war against Putin in Ukraine, not for the public streets of a decent, moral nation. We must finally find the will to stand up to the insanity of the gun lobby, the NRA, and its terrible allies in the militia movement and among the neo-Nazis of America, and end this now. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the fascinating Jewish communities of Egypt over time. We started with Elephantine Island a couple weeks ago. Last week, the incredible Jewish community of Alexandria. Cairo is the most important city in Egypt today, of course, and for a long time, but it didn't become so. It didn't even really exist until the Muslim conquest, and they established Fustat as a major new city, and that's when the Jewish community of Cairo got going. Really important Jewish community and a fascinating kind of center of a lot of things. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Right. So Cairo, first of all, it's the biggest city in Africa by far. It has more than 20 million people. And it is also the biggest city in the Islamic world. It's like the fifth largest city in the world. So a lot of international organizations and businesses, both private and public sector things, have their regional headquarters in Cairo, whether it's for the Middle East or for Africa or whatever. There's a huge expatriate population there. And it was always a cosmopolitan city. Its roots go way back into antiquity. It was a Roman town. But there's some confusion. I mean, you mentioned Fustat. There's there's a dozen places around Cairo that have since been incorporated into this huge megalopolis.
It goes all the way to Giza now. I mean, it's a mega
right.
city.
I mean, the pyramids and the Sphinx and these great things from ancient Egypt were actually built in the capital of one of the Egyptian kingdoms, which was Memphis. Memphis has since disappeared. So has Fustat. They've all been swallowed up by
Cairo, right?
Right.
The ever-growing city. That's right.
Yeah. And modern Cairo wasn't actually founded until the Fatimid dynasty in the 10th century of the Common Era. But it rapidly grew and very soon had like 80,000 Jews. When Ibn Battuta or whatever his name was, the famous Jewish travel writer, was making his rounds of the world, he commented on, this is the largest Jewish community I've ever seen anywhere.
It was the largest Jewish community in the world, probably, very likely.
And certainly at that time, Cairo was the largest city west of China. And so Cairo really has undergone several incarnations. It wasn't effectively a city in the time that the Greeks ruled over Egypt. And it wasn't much of a city when the early Romans ruled over Egypt. But at the time of the Byzantine Empire, it already became a little more important under a different name. You know, one neighborhood that's now part of Cairo was Cairo. But then after the Arabs arrived in the 8th century, and particularly after the Mamluks took over, at the time of Salah ad-Din in the 12th and 13th centuries, Cairo exploded because the Mamluks, although they were also Arabs, so it's a mistake to distinguish between Mamluks and Arabs. It's just a subtype. But they were both great soldiers who defeated all the Crusaders and kicked out the last Crusader state from the Middle East. And they were huge builders. So a lot of the buildings that are now the most ancient buildings in Cairo were built by the Mamluks in the 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. And then when Jews came flooding in from Iberia, including the great Maimonides, that made Cairo.
You can make a case it was the cultural Jewish capital of the world for
right.
a while.
It was definitely the New York of the Jewish world for a few hundred years, more than any city in Europe, more than any city in Israel, which was largely depopulated of its Jews for many centuries, not ever entirely, but So Cairo reached its peak in terms of the Jewish population in the 1940s, because a lot of displaced Jews from Europe settled there. So there was also an Ashkenazic Jewish community, in addition to the homegrown Jews, and in addition to the Jews who arrived from Iberia.
I want to do one more session on Cairo, because there's some really interesting things that took place there within the Jewish world. It's such a fascinating place, although now, of course, almost all the Jews are gone. But, for example, the Ben Ezra Synagogue is still an incredible place, and a lot more to talk about. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Persecution of Jews has existed for many years, including in Rome, the heart of the Catholic Church and the seat of the Pope. Well, back in the Middle Ages, the Pope decided all the Jews had to leave Rome. Naturally, there was an uproar from the whole Jewish community of Rome, but what to do? The chief rabbi of Rome arranged a meeting with the Pope, and he said, "Your Holiness, we Jews have been Roman citizens 1,000 years now. Please don't expel us." The Pope says, "I'll tell you what. Get your most gifted Talmudic scholar, and I'll debate him. If your guy beats me, the Jews stay. But if he loses, the Jews must go." The rabbi puts out a call to all the Roman Jewish citizenry, but no one wants to debate the Pope in Rome. Clearly, it's a lose-lose proposition. Only little Moshe Rabinowitz volunteers. He's a humble stable sweeper, but nobody else will step up, so Moshe gets the job of debating the Pope. But Moshe makes a stipulation. Since the Pope speaks Latin, and Moshe, of course, doesn't, this must be a nonverbal debate, hand signals only. The Pope confidently agrees. The day of the great debate comes between the Pope, the Pontiff of Rome, and humble Moshe Rabinowitz. First, the Pope raises his hand and shows three fingers. So Moshe raises his index finger. The Pope is annoyed, a little disturbed by Moshe's response. Next, the Pope waves his hand in a big circle around his head. Moshe, without hesitation, points to the ground. The Pope is unnerved by this second response. Finally, the Pope pulls out a communion wafer and a glass of wine and holds them up. Moshe reaches into his burlap sack and pulls out an apple. Shaking his head in exasperation and frustration, the Pope stands up and announces, "I give up. This guy is too good. The Jews can stay." The cardinals rush up to the Pope and ask him what happened. The Pope answers, "Look, first I held up three fingers representing the Holy Trinity. The Jew responded, holding up one finger, reminding me that there was still one God. Then I waved my hand around the top of my head to show that God was above all of us. He pointed to the ground, showing God was right here in our midst. Finally," says the Pope, "I showed him the holy sacraments, the wine and the wafer, demonstrating Jesus absolves us from sin. But then he pulled out an apple, reminding me of original sin. This guy has an answer for everything. What can I do? The Jews can stay." The relieved Jewish community crowds around Moshe, amazed that this insignificant man did what all the scholars were afraid to even try. "What happened?" they ask Moshe. "Well," says Moshe, "he showed me three fingers, which means the Jews have 3 days to get out of Rome. I held up one finger to tell him not one of us is leaving. Then the Pope waved his hand in a circle around the top of his head, showing Rome had to be cleared of all its Jews. I pointed to the ground to tell him, this is our home. We stay." "And then?" the Jews asked Moshe. "I don't really know," said Moshe. "He took out his lunch. I took out mine." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests are commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance. The Torah quotes God saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection to us. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the Kohans, if you will, highest class of priests, those who were entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use this blessing at every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. The text is, may God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace. In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing requesting physical safety and health. The second asks for our material needs to be satisfied, and the third blessing seeks spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become a challenge, but with all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, those three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives and a true gift from God. May you each be blessed with every one of these, all of these, this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Aaron Henney, will discuss how his collaborative theater troupe, Theater Dybbuk, award-winning interpreters of exceptional Jewish plays they create and recreate, has revived the oldest Jewish play ever. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a story that could only happen in the conservative movement of America, a couple attending a bar mitzvah last week on Zoom left their camera on while they were fulfilling an important Shabbat mitzvah, or double mitzvah, as some people used to call it. The Zoom incident at a synagogue at a Sabbath morning service in St. Louis Park, a suburb of Minneapolis, occurred because the more traditional conservative shul has a set-it-and-forget-it policy about attending services on Shabbat. That is, according to the movement's important committee on law and standards, you are allowed to use electronics on the Sabbath as a conservative Jew so long as you put them on before Shabbat begins Friday night and don't change them until after it's over Saturday night. In other words, according to some authorities in the conservative movement, you can use Zoom as long as you leave it on for the entirety of Shabbat. But maybe you should figure out how to shut off the video in your bedroom. The couple was unaware their Zoom camera caught their, interaction and broadcast it for some 45 minutes before somebody decided to break her own observance of this rule and phone the couple to alert them to their new video status. No doubt, this is a bar mitzvah nobody in attendance will ever forget. In much more serious news, Rabbi Pinchas Stolper, a pioneer in making Orthodox Judaism accessible to young people, died last week at the age of 90. The OU, the Orthodox Union, said Rabbi Stolper was a trailblazing pioneer in the education of Jewish teens. He served as the first full-time national director of NCSY and as the longest-serving executive vice president of the Orthodox Union. He created and developed modalities of experiential Jewish learning and living that have become the standard for inspiring commitment in Jewish students around the world. Stolper showed his potential for youth leadership when in 1950, at the age of 18, he organized a protest against an official visit of a German soccer team to New York. The horrors of the Nazi years were still being revealed. Stolper was furious a German delegation would be honored at City Hall. He and about a dozen of his friends pelted the team with tomatoes. Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, the director of Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin Yeshiva, read the news of Stolper's arrest next morning and declared to a colleague, "This young man has chutzpah. We need him in our yeshiva." Stolper became close to Huttner, a leading figure in mid-20th century American Orthodoxy. He himself soon rose to positions of influence within the modern Orthodox movement. During more than 40 years of working with Jewish youth, Rabbi Stolper built the NCSY movement from coast to coast, the Orthodox Union said. He wrote a stack of books, making the holidays and Shabbat more accessible to younger leaders, and also wrote a book of advice on relationships, Jewish alternatives in love, dating, and marriage. Stolper also was a key in advancing the career of the great Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan of blessed memory, whose extraordinary writings on the Torah and Kabbalah and Jewish thought in the 1970s and 80s are credited with spurring a return to Orthodoxy among young Jews. I was taken by his unusual ability to explain a difficult topic, Stolper said of Aryeh Kaplan, one usually reserved for advanced scholars, a topic almost untouched previously in English with such simplicity it could be understood by any intelligent reader. It was clear to me that his special talent could fill a significant void in English Judaica. He was right. Kaplan's work is still essential. Stolper retired from leading the Orthodox Union in the year 2000 after 18 years, when the New York Jewish Week exposed decades of allegations of physical and sexual abuse of minors by a Rabbi Baruch Lanner, who was under his supervision. Stolper said at the time that he had been made aware of some of the allegations but could not substantiate them to the point of taking action. Lanner went on to serve 3 years in prison for abusing two girls at a New Jersey school. And Rabbi Steve Sager died last week, much too soon, of pancreatic cancer at the age of 71. I knew Steve from a wonderful summer kollel of rabbis that meets annually in the North Carolina mountains. When I first started out as a congregational rabbi, I served the synagogue in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that was closest to the Wild Acres Retreat Center, where this great group meets. It was there I met Steve and his wife Sibby and their children. Had a chance to experience his creativity, incredible warmth, humor, kindness, generosity, and scholarship. A Reconstructionist rabbi, Steve Sager served a conservative shul in Durham, North Carolina for many years. He also taught at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical School. Steve Sager was a great model of loving congregational leadership, but what I will always be grateful to Steve for was the way he openly showed affection to his then teenage kids, embracing them. That wasn't precisely the way that I was raised, and I hadn't really seen other rabbis with that kind of relationship with their kids. But I decided then and there that that was what I would strive for. And while I don't know that I always succeeded, as I think Steve and Sibby did, he made it so much easier for me to connect with my own children as they grew up. It was okay to embrace them, to tell them I love them, even when they were, frankly, insufferable teenagers. There are famous rabbis whom people in the various movements have heard of, and there are prominent rabbinic leaders whose books and talks have great influence. But there are others who touch us in quite different ways. Rabbi Steve Sager influenced me in a way that I will always be grateful for, and I know he did the same for so many people over the course of his excellent rabbinate. May his memory bring only blessings. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish Art guests this morning. Aaron Henney is the artistic director of Theater Dybbuk, a remarkable and innovative theater company in California. He has done, oh boy, all kinds of things, a multimedia adaptation of a 12th century epic poem. He has been a Wexner Fellow, taught at American Jewish University in its Dream Lab, at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, one of my alma maters. I don't know if that's the correct term, alma maters, but we'll take it. Worked both in the academic side and the performance side in exploring theater and dance and all that it might be. Can you tell us how you decide in Theater Dybbuk what your next project is going to be?
So we decide what our next project is going to be in a variety of ways. So one is, first, let me, before I get into the decision-making process, we build our shows over 1 to 2.5 to 3 years per project using an ensemble development process. We're having script meetings where I'm bringing in pages that I'm writing. We're having scholars talk to us. We're doing research, and it takes quite a while. So just to frame for the listeners, when we say choosing our next project, we are really choosing a point of departure, a jumping off point from which we will create something. And it happens in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's that I, as artistic director, get really curious about something going on in our world and seek out a Jewish point of entry to discuss that topic in our world. Sometimes it's that a member of the ensemble comes to me and says, oh, there's this really interesting thing I read or saw, and I wonder if it would make an interesting play. And so it happens in a variety of ways. For example, one of my favorite stories about that was our 2019 work explored a piece called Toftei Ruch, which we roughly translated to Hell Prepared. And it was an exploration of a descent into Gehenna that was written by a mystic a rabbi named Moshe Zacuto in the ghettos of Italy. And that's because a scholar who's an artist of the company, a contributing scholar named Avery Jaffe Berg, came to me and said, I'm working on a translation with Michela Andreata of this work, and we think it could be really interesting to explore. And then from there, we went, well, what's this work saying? And why is it doing this exploration? So as you can hear, though, it happens in a variety of ways, but it's definitely collaborative in nature.
That collaboration, I'll go back to Exegog and then come forward a little bit too. At Exegog, how many lines did you have to actually work with in creating an entire production? Because, plays can be longer or shorter, but what were you starting with Exegog, and how did you build it?
So Exegog, the fragments only contain 269 lines. So probably less than one-fifth of the entire length of the play. And as I mentioned, they're fragments, so they are from different parts of the piece. And so what we did was, first, we of course read through those fragments and kind of tried to understand what parts of the story they were expressing. And then we got curious about, okay, so what parts of the Exodus story are missing, of course, so we discussed that. And then we really discussed and tried to research about Hellenistic Judaism and understanding the circumstances in which people were living at that time in order to understand what the purpose of this piece might be. And then once we got a little bit of a grasp on that, we then said, if that's the purpose of that time, what's our purpose today? And we tried to meld those two things together. So the resulting piece had the ancient text. It also had, of course, direct allusions to the Exodus narrative as we know it. And then it also incorporated contemporary narratives of refugees and immigrants because of what we were exploring in our world today, and aligning that exploration with the text we had in front of us.
When you create a play based on something in which you only have fragments, you have to employ creativity, don't you? How do you decide what feels authentic and what feels like doesn't quite fit with what you're creating?
So first, there's a lot of blind alleys. There's a lot of experimenting and accepting that something may not fit in order to find that which does fit. So we usually create 300 to 500 pages of script for what will eventually be the 60 to 70 page work. So just to frame it, the decision-making process is very iterative, it's very time-consuming, and it's about getting it wrong before one gets it right. And I think that the way we eventually decide is we just have to stick to some really fundamental questions about how is this sequence moving the story forward? And if it's not moving the story forward, and I don't just mean the plot, I mean the emotional story, the underpinnings, if it's not moving them forward, then even if it's interesting, it might not belong. And then, of course, there are the questions of what are we leaving people to wrestle with? And if we are telling them what to think instead of leaving them with something to sit with and process and grapple with and ask questions of, then we're probably not in the right place. At least that's for us as a company. So we try and present things that are provocations to deeper thought.
When you guys create a piece, how do you know where the audience is going to be? Do you have set theaters you work with? Do you try to think about it as, gosh, this would be a great thing to present at in this city? Like, how does it work?
So every piece is a little bit different. Exegog, for example, we knew we wanted to do it in kind of an amphitheater setting because of the allusion to Greek theater. And we wanted to be in places that could reach a diverse audience, people from a diversity of backgrounds, lived experiences, and so forth. So that particular piece was done in a unique manner. We actually toured it to three different locations in Los Angeles. One was a synagogue that has a very artistically interested audience. One was a cultural museum called the Fowler Museum at UCLA, and another was Grand Park, which is a big, you know, outdoor park in the center of downtown Los Angeles.
You should have done it in the Greek Theater, right? It just seems like the right name, if not the right place. Sorry, go ahead.
As
an Angelino, I think about these things.
Oh, right, to do it in the Greek, right. And look, that would have been amazing.
Yeah.
Of course, we are also leveraging partnerships, people we know, what's available.
Yes, of course,
But I think, but yes, Greek Theater. Next year at the Greek.
Take me to the Greek. Okay, right. Sorry.
So we purposely wanted to be in different geographic locations. I should mention the synagogue was Temple Israel of Hollywood. And we also wanted places that would reach audiences for a variety of reasons. So actually our goal with that piece was to reach the most people we could from different lived experiences. I mean, when we did it at Grand Park, for example, it's remarkable. City Hall is literally right behind us as we're playing.
Yeah, that's right.
Where we are talking
it's
about
right downtown, the heart of downtown. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Obviously, Exegog, the oldest piece you've done of Jewish work, not the only thing. What other projects are you working on now?
Sure. So right now, we've been doing a number of things. One is, you know, we have our own podcast, a very different but a nice cousin to yours called the Dipicast, where we actually every month we explore a creative Jewish text from at some point in history and marry that with an interview with a scholar or multiple scholars so that you're hearing readings combined with people illuminating what those readings say about the world in which they were created and thus perhaps about our world today. So we've been doing a variety of those episodes throughout the last couple of years. We have been in development for a few years on a piece that actually explores anti-Semitism and explores what are the reasons for it occurring and conspiracy theory and false narratives. And that's called Breaking Protocols.
I was looking at that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, please. Because it explodes and explores the fraudulent anti-Semitic text, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So we've been working on that. And that's a really interesting, challenging thing to process. We also are in process of, not yet ready to announce it, but I will tell you, we are about to explore a very familiar text that has connections to Jewish history that is sometimes misunderstood or maybe not fully contextualized, and we are going to be looking to marry deep scholarship with this very familiar text and maybe bring it to life in a way that people have never experienced. So more on that to come.
I'm excited to hear about that. Now, your work combines some of your background, right? Dance, theater, a variety of other media. You like to push against the kind of boundaries that separate things. How does that work in the process of creating what you do? Does everybody involved with Theater Dybbuk have to have that diverse experience?
So I think one of the beautiful things about working with experts, you know, is that people bring their own expertise, their own experience, and we put that experience in dialogue with others. So, you know, for example, I have an expertise in playwriting and dramaturgy and to some extent directing, while then our choreographer's expertise is in creating meaningful movement, and our composer's expertise is in obviously creating music and having it speak and sing, and on and on. And so while almost everyone in the ensemble certainly has worked in multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary ways, I think what gives it its strength is that I will turn to the choreographer and say, here is what I'm looking for in this section. And then I'll let the choreographer do their job. And then my job as director will be come in and say, oh, that we're getting there. Now let's figure out what's missing. But they're leading the way in that moment. And I think that's the power of this. Just like when I work with actors, when I'm directing, I'm generally not an acting coach. I trust that the actors will bring what they know about how to bring a text to life, and I'm merely just slightly pushing or encouraging some shaping, but I'm not telling them how to do their job. So I think that's what makes this a really powerful process, is that people are able to fully own who they are and the skills they've developed over many years and put those skills in dialogue with others.
Okay, so here's a nasty question. What's your favorite project that you've worked on with Theater Dybbuk?
It's a great question. Oh, I love them all.
Yeah, they're all my children, I understand.
They're all my children. You know, I will answer that by saying, genuinely, I don't have a favorite. I think that when one works on pieces for this length of time, each one has its own life and its own lessons to teach me as an artist. And it doesn't mean each one is equally successful. You know, I think there are certainly stronger works than others. There are works where I think we really got it right, and works where I think we're close, but there's still things that could be improved. I will say that there is, of course, a beautiful, you know, place in my heart for our first work, which was called Cave, A Dance for Lilith. And it explored Lilith folklore. For those who don't know, Lilith sometimes identified as the first woman before Eve in a variety of ways. It explored Lilith folklore and Hebrew goddess mythology. And it was 5 dancers, 2 actors, live music. And I think the warm place in my heart for it is because it was the first work, and it really made a statement about what we intended with this company and how we were going to put work out there that asked a lot of audience and asked them to concentrate and to lean in. And while I look back at that work and I go, oh, there's room for improvement, there's things now a decade later I would do differently as an artist, I honor that it set us on a trajectory and taught me something about what was possible.
So one last question. What kind of a job is this for a nice Jewish boy?
That's a perfect job for a nice Jewish boy. You know, I will say that one of the things I feel really fortunate about is that, so Theodor Dybek does this deep theatrical work, and we also get brought into a lot of communities to work with communities on storytelling and leadership and Jewish education. And I think that marriage of the artistic work and community service has really fed me, and it's been reciprocal. It feeds the communities we're in, and back and forth the circle goes, and we all grow together. So that will be my way of saying it's a nice job for a nice Jewish boy.
I want to thank Aaron Henney for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about Theodor Dybek and to find out more about you?
Great, thank you. They can visit us at theodordybek.org. That's theater with an R-E, because we're fancy. Theodordybek.org. And they can learn more about us there and sign up for our mailing list, and they can listen to the Dybek cast on Apple Podcasts or wherever they listen, and just would be glad to hear from people. Thank you for asking.
Thank you so much, Aaron. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Ellen Frankel, author of the new thriller, The Deadly Scrolls, past editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society for some 18 years, and the author of 10 books and 2 operas. She's great. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, all live in person and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from the late great klezmer clarinetist Giora Feidman, his version of Karl Bach's V'hayarei Neinu, Open Our Eyes to Your Torah, for the holiday of Shavuot, the celebration of receiving the Torah today. My friends, have a Chag Shavuot Sameach, a happy holiday of Shavuos, and Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.